Davy could tarnish Ireland globally. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Examiner, which quotes UCD Professor Niamh Brennan and other corporate governance experts saying that the government and the NTMA risk bringing the state into disrepute if they allow Davy to participate in a sale of Irish sovereign bonds this week after the stockbroking firm was fined €4.1 million last week when the central bank found that 16 of its employees had profited in the sale of Anglo-Irish bank bonds in 2014. For its lead story, meanwhile, the Irish Times reports that the 16 individuals may now face the possibility of personal sanction from the central bank. Speaking on RTÉ's The Week in Politics, Minister for Public Enterprise and Reform Michael McGrath said that the regulator has a range of sanctions available, including fines and barring people from working in a regulated firm. The Irish Independent leads with the line that it's unlikely there will be an immediate cut in insurance premiums despite the move to reduce awards to personal injury claimants. The paper quotes comments made by Moya Murdoch, the chief executive of Insurance Ireland, saying that premiums will be reduced over time and that her body believes that the guidelines don't go far enough to address the high cost of claims in Ireland. That shooting in Bluebell in Dublin on Saturday, which resulted in a man and woman being hospitalised and four men being arrested, generates the lead story in the Irish Daily Star and Irish Sun. The Irish Daily Mail leads this morning with the vaccine-related story. The Belfast Telegraph leads with today's return to school for primary school children in the younger age groups in Northern Ireland. In common with the Irish News, the Telegraph also runs with the front page picture of Rangers fans in Belfast last night flouting COVID regulations as they celebrated their team's victory in the Scottish League. For its lead story, meanwhile, the Irish News reports on a gun smuggled into the north by a loyalist during the Troubles, which has been linked to the murder of up to 12 people between 1988 and 1994. The Irish Daily Mirror leads this morning with Oprah Winfrey's interview with the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, which is to be aired on RTÉ2 tonight. And there are lots of pictures of women in today's papers to mark International Women's Day. Vicky Phelan is pictured on the front of the Examiner talking on a video call from the US where she's receiving ongoing treatment for cancer. There's a picture of three members of the same family from Dundalk who between them have 80 years of service with the Irish Red Cross on the front of the Independent. And finally, the Times runs with an image on its front page of five new portraits of inspirational women from the world of science and technology, which is being unveiled today in DCU. The pictures were commissioned as part of Accenture's Women on Walls programme.
We've had three resignations at stockbroker Davy this weekend following the €4.13 million fine by the central bank over a bond deal scandal. Its chief executive, head of bonds and deputy chairman are all stepping down from their roles. Should more heads roll and will the central bank now focus on the behaviour of the individuals involved? John O'Connell is General Secretary of the Financial Services Union. John, good morning.
Good morning, Mary.
The central bank didn't mince its words. Davy acted in a reckless manner in allowing this deal to go ahead. The firm's been fined. We've had the three senior resignations and a review taking place. But is that sufficient?
I don't think so. I think, given the lack of transparency and the fact that the central bank accused Davies of being vague and misleading at the start of the investigation, I think there's a reputational issue here for the whole sector that needs to be addressed and that needs to be investigated further very quickly. I think the length of the investigation needs explaining as well why it took that long to get to this point. But I think there needs to be a very thorough review independently of Davies to see what else is there in terms of the operation of Davies.
What's been the reaction of the members that you represent who work within the stockbroking firm?
I think in terms of the how people feel about it is that it's a dem and us. It's more of the dem and us. It goes to culture. It questions why the Sears legislation isn't in place. And it also highlights, Mary, the fact that no one was speaking up. So the initiatives to get people to speak up, particularly in the finance sector, are not working and certainly didn't work in this instance.
You raise the Sears legislation. This is the Senior Executive Accountability Regime. It's in the programme for government. The Minister for Finance says heads of bill, they're coming, it's on the way. What difference would it make?
I think in terms of accountability, it's changing and shifting from a situation where you're holding banks accountable to holding senior bankers accountable. I think in other jurisdictions, that's seen to be much, much more effective. We see in the tracker mortgages, by the time the fines come to get paid, it's just a balance sheet issue for the institution and they move on. And nobody is held accountable. Sears should hold people accountable.
There are immediate issues coming up. On Thursday, Davy is involved in an Irish sovereign bond sale. Should they still be involved in that?
Well, I think the government has to answer that question, frankly, in terms of, I think the Irish people are looking to see what the government will do. And in the absence of that type of regulation, people are looking to the government to give a lead now and to demonstrate that when wrongdoing is identified, that there's consequences for that.
We will have the central bank before the Oireachtas Finance Committee tomorrow. Should Davy also be going before that committee?
I believe they should. I think they should be publicly accountable in relation to this. It relates to a time where this country was in great difficulty, and I think they should be there to explain themselves and explain why they were vague and misleading in the investigation, as the Central Bank has said in its report. I think they have to account for themselves.
So you have concerns here around, I'm sure, the jobs of your members and the security of the jobs of your members. I mean, how deeply will this reputational damage affect the company and the client base it represents?
I think our concerns are sector-wide. That anything like this, we need to know, first of all, that this was a once-off and that it wasn't inbuilt into the culture and DNA of the organisation, and that it's not further in terms of the sector. So I think we need to get to the heart of this very, very quickly and understand that it was a once-off, if that's what it was, and understand who's going to take accountability for this beyond the three individuals who so far have been held accountable by Davies. So I think it's broader than that, and I think it goes to culture in the sector in terms of the controls were easily circumvented. We hear on a daily basis the sector complaining about the burden of regulation, and this is why regulation is needed. The culture hasn't yet matured to a stage where it polices itself.
The public would find that extraordinary, that we came through a financial crash. We were promised greater regulation, increased accountability, and we arrive here in 2021, you know, a full 12 years on from the financial crash, and we're still raising similar questions about regulation and accountability.
Yeah, it goes to culture and behaviours. So people behave like this because they believe they're going to not be held to account. And so that's why you need a Sears regime in place in order to hold people to account. And it's across the sector that there's a cultural divide in terms of how they think in terms of different things. If you look last week, 100 branches closed in Bank of Ireland. Cap looked to be lifted by the chairman, and yet that bank is at a gap of 24% in terms of gender pay today on International Women's Day. So there's things in the sector that need to be addressed. This is a very important one, but there's other things that are really important to people, and gender pay being obviously a key one.
Okay, we leave it there, John, and thank you very much for joining us. That's John O'Connell, the General Secretary of the Financial Services Union. It's 18 minutes past 7.
COVID-19 vaccination continues this week. Older and more vulnerable people are still the priority, along with healthcare workers and frontline staff. But what's the plan for some of the more marginalised groups in society, such as those living in homeless accommodation and members of the travelling community? Angus Cox reports.
It's not out long enough for us to know, are we safe enough to let people inject small amounts of corona into us? Do you get what I'm saying?
I'll say to you, we know this is a really serious disease. We have this vaccine that aren't sure, but we're fairly certain it's safe.
Dr. Austin O'Carroll debating the COVID-19 vaccine with Mary, a patient at his drop-in clinic for the homeless in Dublin. Dr. O'Carroll is the HSE's clinical lead for the COVID homeless response in the Dublin region. And when it comes to engaging with patients about the vaccine, he favours a personal approach.
It's the personal element between the staff and between the doctors talking to the clients was what will really drive it. People understand the seriousness of the illness. Some of them get worried about the effects of the vaccine, and so they don't fully understand how effective vaccines have been in the past in clearing diseases. Smallpox, in the 100 years before it was eradicated, caused 300 million deaths. A vaccine eradicated it. I think they need to have the confidence that I am willing to take the vaccine, that I've gone through the same rationalization process. So once they understand that I'm willing to do it and I've thought it through, and they understand the things that I've had to think through as well, I do think the vast majority come on board and do it.
This approach seems to be working, with Mary, who is currently homeless and staying in a hostel, now comfortable about taking the vaccine.
At first I was like, no way, why would you inject coronavirus into me? Dr. Austin, like, when he sat me down and he explained things properly, I'm all for it now. I don't think we get as much information and stuff as other people would. Well, for me, I have my phone and my Google and stuff, but if I want to know something really, like today, Dr. Austin, my key worker, but mostly my key workers, then they get kind of stuck and they're like, okay, go to Dr. Austin. So yeah, Dr. Austin, he's my Superman.
So what does the vaccine rollout plan look like for the homeless?
Firstly, we have a plan ready to roll out. So we have a number of organisations, SafetyNet, GMQ, DePaul, McVerry, Simon, ALDP, who are all ready to roll out with teams of doctors and nurses to, one, go vaccinate people in hostels, but also they can come here to the drop-ins to get vaccinated as well as with their own GPs. So they have three possibilities of getting vaccinated. And the idea is if they don't go to their own GPs or don't come in here, we'll get them in the hostels in the mornings or the evenings when they're there. And we've done this with the flu vaccine for up to 15 years at this stage, so we are expert in doing this. The key issue is that we need to be able to vaccinate everybody at the same time. If we have to go out and vaccinate people of a certain age with conditions and then come back a few weeks later to another group, that's going to be incredibly messy in terms of rollout. And I also think will cause problems amongst the clients because they'll say, why are you getting it and we're not getting it?
Hi Angus, welcome. This is the SafetyNet Community Assessment Hub.
Like with homeless people, the rollout of the vaccine to other marginalised groups is likely to differ from the mainstream approach.
My name's Angela Skuse. I'm a GP and the Medical Director of SafetyNet Primary Care. SafetyNet is a charity that provides healthcare to people who couldn't otherwise access it. Different groups really have different ideas and different approaches to the vaccine. So some of the groups we've been working with have been the travelling community. SafetyNet knew that the groups that we work with would not be well served by the mainstream services that were set up for COVID. We set up a testing centre with a mobile testing unit that would go out to them. We set up a community assessment hub and then a COVID cluster response team. The travelling community have had very high rates, but we've had very good engagement from them going out. From our conversations with them, I think that they would be, in general, have a high uptake of the vaccine. The question is getting it to them.
However, SafetyNet's engagement with another group, the Roma community, highlights the possible challenges when it comes to administering the vaccine among these groups.
Well, the vulnerable Roma people that we work with have a great fear of the vaccine. A lot of them have had bad experiences with healthcare in the countries that they come from. There's lots of misinformation going around that the vaccine will cause infertility, that it'll cause their children to be born deformed. And there's particular rumours about a microchip being implanted with the vaccine. So various groups have done a lot of work in preparing education material in a way that they can access it.
Are you confident that when the time comes for the Roma community, for the travelling community, for migrant workers to get the vaccine, that uptake will be at a high level where you want it to be?
I think so. I think there are signs already that people's attitudes are changing and improving. Part of that is due to the great work on education that's being done. And it's people who really know what they're doing. They're providing culturally specific information in a way that's accessible to people.
Dr. Angela Skuse from Safety Net, ending that report by Angus Cox. Now, 70% of our electricity must be produced from renewable energy by the end of this decade. That's set out by government in its Climate Action Plan. It's a major undertaking with significant investment needed for the electricity network or the national grid to make it happen. And so a 14-week public consultation period will be announced today by the government and the grid's operator, EirGrid. Its Chief Executive, Mark Foley, joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Audrey.
And you're welcome to the programme. Public support is critical for your plans to bring more renewable electricity to the grid. They found that out in Denmark and Germany. Can you guarantee that people's views will be listened to and taken on board?
Absolutely, Audrey. I mean, this is as ambitious a consultation programme I think ever undertaken by a company in Ireland. It's called Shaping Our Electricity Future, and at the heart of it is a transparent expose of a number of options to allow us achieve the government objective and a commitment to listen and to engage widely, nationally, regionally and locally, and to get the voice of the people of Ireland firmly into the heart of this discussion, so that when we pick the right option and the best option for Ireland Inc., it'll be one that genuinely has heard people's voices and that is the best option in terms of impact, cost, etc.
Is it based around wind and solar power? Is there anything else in the plan?
It's primarily based around the natural resource that is wind in Ireland, both onshore wind and offshore wind. Onshore wind has served us exceedingly well, but we will see the introduction of significant amounts of offshore wind and a reasonable amount of solar and the deployment of significant technology on the grid, which will help the grid stay stable when we have high levels of renewables on the system.
How will you get, I mean, the wind in particular, how will you get the wind energy from, say, the west of Ireland to the east of Ireland?
That's a really good question, because the essence and part of this consultation programme is actually looking at different ways by which these different variables can be managed. So one of the solutions, for example, is what we call generation-led, and that is to locate generation in locations that are close to big demand sources, such as Dublin. Another option is to look at demand-led, and that's to put sources of demand consumption in locations that are near strong grids and near sources of generation. So the essence of this approach is to dispassionately look at those different scenarios and find the one that gets the right balance across the different variables.
To have enough energy and to have energy security is critical for our infrastructure. It's critical for investment in the country. Could you be in a position where you are, not you per se, but the government and so on, the policy in this area will be directing where the big users of our power will locate?
It may very well do. And part of this approach, and that's why we've set out four approaches, is to explore those very points where policy plays a significant role in helping us achieve the optimum pathway to 2030. The mechanism that's got us to where we are, which is very successful, we'll achieve approximately 40% renewables on the power system last year, which was substantially a developer-led approach. So that has served us very well to date. But we believe that policy intervention will be very important as we make the big step from 40% to 70%.
And hand on heart, is that doable in 9 years?
I think yes is the short answer, and there's a number of reasons for that. We have a phenomenal ecosystem already established over 20 years in onshore wind. We have projects in the Irish Sea pretty well ready to go, and that'll be another source of high volume generation of renewable energy. And this process will allow us then to come up with the best grid solution. The ecosystem's there, the technology is there, the capital is there in terms of the investment, substantially coming from the private sector. A lot of the challenge is about getting the people of Ireland behind the solution and supporting us in the execution of the solution. And that is what Shaping Our Electricity Future is all about, getting people engaged so then we can get on with it when we pick the right solution.
But the cost of upgrading this, the national grid, is anything from €500 million up to €2 billion. We are all looking, presumably, at an increase in the cost of our electricity ultimately.
No, I don't believe so, because if you look at what has been achieved in Ireland in the last 15 years in going from zero renewables to 300 wind farms in Ireland today across 80% of Irish counties, the cost of electricity to consumers arising from renewables has not increased in the last 15 years. I believe firmly that we can achieve the next quantum of this challenge by 2030 for three reasons. The government renewable energy auction process will drive serious competition amongst developers. Secondly, technology is driving massive reductions in the cost of energy for wind and solar, particularly offshore wind. And thirdly, this shaping our electricity future is going to help us find the most cost-effective route to getting to 2030. All in all, I think eventually we'll see prices fall.
Well, we will hold you to that. And just a final question in terms of fossil fuels. Will we still need them? Will you still be relying on them to some extent come 2030?
Yes, is the short answer. Low carbon gas is absolutely critical to system security today and will be for the next decade and beyond until we find an appropriate zero carbon solution. But the new gas that we will be deploying and the new plant will be highly efficient, much lower in terms of carbon emissions, and it will see off the coal, the peat and the oil plants over the next number of years as we transition to renewables and low carbon gas.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning, the Chief Executive of Airgrid, Mark Foley.
For every €1 men earn, women earn 86 cents. That's the scale of the gender pay gap in Ireland. The National Women's Council of Ireland said the gender pay gap was further compounded by the pension gap that women face on retirement. Gender pay gap legislation requiring employers to publish pay differences between men and women, including any bonuses, is expected to be made into law this year. The government is to press the insurance industry to reduce the cost of premiums following a revision of guidelines for personal injury awards. The chief executives of the major insurance companies will be contacted today. Irish people who are working from home have put in 300 million hours overtime since the start of the pandemic, according to research from Laya Healthcare, which measured the well-being of over 1,000 Irish employees. The findings show two-thirds feel pressure to stay connected after normal hours, with an average of 22 hours put in of overtime per month over the last year. On the currencies, €1 buys 86.1 pence sterling and $1 19 cents.
Very busy Monday morning in the world of sport. Let's start with Sam Bennett and that wonderful stage victory for him in the week-long Paris-Nice race yesterday, taking stage one. The Paris-Nice race, one of the most prestigious events outside the Grand Tours. And the win means he'll wear the race leader's yellow jersey on stage two today. And he really is a rider in super form at the moment. Won two stages at the UAE Tour last month. And I think he's in this sort of form, he's going to go from strength to strength. Maybe he can even cap what he did last year. Let's wait and see. By the way, the finish yesterday was incredibly impressive because he got the timing spot on, uphill finish towards the end, and then he just powered his way over that line. Let's hear how it finished.
There in the blue, it's Sam Bennett, and it's going to be Bora Hansgrohe trying to lead these out. But here comes Arnaud Démare on the left-hand side, the French champion. Arnaud Démare is there. Ackermann now hits the front. Ackermann going all the way. Bennett coming around on the right-hand side. There goes Sam Bennett. Look at the strength, and Sam Bennett does it. That is a wonderful win for the Irishman.
Yeah, I was really happy. I was a bit worried when I come back here and was racing the whole day rather than the last 10-20 kilometres that maybe the legs wouldn't be there in the sprints, but it felt pretty good today, and I'm really happy that the shape is good now.
Yeah, well done to him. Well done also to Leona Maguire. She had a brilliant top 10 finish at the Drive On Championships in Florida last night. Leona ended the event in a tie for 6th place, 5 under par, 10 behind the winner, Austin Ernest, having a really good season. Just her second on the LPGA Tour, and Stephanie Meadow finished on 1 over par. Bryson DeChambeau beat Lee Westwood by a shot to win the Arnold Palmer Invitational. Rory McIlroy back in a share of 10th place on 3. 3 under par, 8 behind the winner. Disappointing 76 for him to end with yesterday. Padraig Harrington also had a 76 and he was back on 1 over par. Now on the athletics, Sean Tobin finished 11th in the final of the 3,000 metres at the European Indoor Championships. Sarah Lavin and Kieran Neville didn't progress beyond the semi-finals of their 60 metre hurdle events and 60 metre races. Molly Scott and Joan Healy exited in the 60 metre heats. But let's get some reaction from Sarah Lavin. And I think this clip sums up the mood from the Irish team. Disappointed not to do better in a race, but determined to get even better this year.
Disappointed. I came today to run quicker, of course. I don't think there's a long time I needed to break 8 seconds to make a European final. And the standard is sick. And credit to the girls. I have to go back and work harder, but I've had a great season. The most important year is Olympic year, and there's so much to be grateful for, and I was competitive at this championship, so I think that's what's probably most important.
Yeah, Sarah putting the best foot forward there, and it's been such a stop-start 12 months for these athletes. I think these championships will really stand them ahead of what's going to be, hopefully, a very important year for them. Manchester City's winning run in the Premier League came to an end. They lost 2-0 to Manchester United. An early penalty from Bruno Fernandes was followed up with a second-half goal by Luke Shaw in the second half. Great strike from the fullback. Big win for United, but they're still 11 points behind the leaders. Liverpool have lost again. They went down 1-0 to Fulham. This is some slump from the champions who've lost their last 6 home games. They're 8th in the standings. And I think we're all at a loss to explain what has happened to Liverpool this campaign. Let's hear Jurgen Klopp's take on it all.
We never had a momentum in that season, really, in the Premier League at least. And you can see that. It's still in the boys there. They have it all. But in a moment, they can't show it. And yeah, it would be a masterpiece to find out how we change that overnight. The only good thing is that we play a different competition in 3 days. And hopefully we can show there a different face.
Yeah, that game he's talking about is on Wednesday. Liverpool travel to Budapest. They take on RB Leipzig in the second leg of their Champions League last 16 game. They do lead 2-0, but I'm sure Liverpool fans will be very nervous watching that one. Tottenham beat Crystal Palace 4-1. They move above Liverpool and into sixth place. 2 goals from Gareth Bale and Harry Kane in that one. West Brom and Newcastle drew 0-0. Rangers are champions in Scotland for the first time since 2011, following Celtic's scoreless draw against Dundee United. That is your sport for now. Sports updates throughout the day on the RTE Sport website, and you can also check out the RTE News app. Back in an hour.
An overhaul of the CAO system for college entry will see apprenticeships and further education included in a new connected structure. The new process, it's part of a 3-year plan to be announced by Simon Harris, Minister for Further and Higher Education, later this morning. Now, the revamped strategy is being spearheaded by the state agency Solace. Its chief executive is Andrew Brownlee. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, Mary.
So if I was a student doing Leaving Cert in 2022, because this is when the change will all start, what is going to change for me, whether I'm applying for an apprenticeship or a more traditional third level entry like engineering or arts or education?
Well, I think first of all, Mary, it's important to think about why we're doing this. I think we currently have a situation where 2/3 of school leavers go directly into higher education. We even have some schools where that's the case for 100% of leavers, with a much smaller proportion choosing a further education course or an apprenticeship. I suppose we have a strong sense that those types of options would suit a much bigger base of school leavers, but they need the tools to make the smarter choices. And that's really what this is about. I think there's two aspects to this. One is making sure that they have all the information to hand about all of the further education, higher education, apprenticeship options, and there's a great new initiative called The Right Course that's been launched by the Minister to do that. But secondly, and this is really the crux of it, when young people are at that decision point on what to do next, talking to teachers, parents, guidance counsellors, that obviously revolves around CAO time, and we have to find a way to put in place a system that puts those further education options on the table at exactly the same time, either via the CAO itself or, as you mentioned, a kind of parallel and connected system.
So are you designing here a single portal?
I think that would be the ideal ultimate goal, Mari. We're obviously very conscious that CAO is a private independent company with its own board. We're very conscious that education and training boards that provide those further education options are independent education providers. But really what we want to make sure is the system is as simple as possible for the school leaver so that they can see all of the options that are available when they're making that decision about the future of their lives and their careers and their study plans. And so we want to get as close to a central portal as possible along the line.
So will the students have that clarity from 2022? And what are you going to do about governance and who's actually going to run the system?
Well, I tell you, what we can promise people by 2022 is that they will have a much clearer sense of what their further education options are and what all the great options across apprenticeship are, you know, as part of the decision process in terms of what you do when you leave school. So as I say, it's a complex process. There's an awful lot of work to do with partners like the CAO and the education providers. But we believe, you know, there's a real strong ambition here. It's something that society in Ireland needs, and you know we're committed to working with those partners to make it happen.
Are we out of step with some of our European neighbours in terms of access to further education? We have a significant dropout rate from university, even higher at IT level. And is this part of trying to address those numbers?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to say is we have an excellent higher education system and that's internationally respected. But in terms of the balance between the role of further education and apprenticeship and higher education, we are a little bit out of kilter. But one thing I would say, Mari, is it's not an either-or choice. I think, you know, we have really strong evidence now that if you do a further education course first and then progress into higher education, you have a much better chance of finishing your degree than if you go in straight into higher ed, you know, with maybe 300, 350 points. So that's how we need to start thinking about the system. You know, we need to think about models perhaps where you start your degree in a further education college and then progress on to a university or an IOT to kind of finish your degree, you know. And that will certainly very much bring us into line with some of those international models. And I think set us up to meet the needs of the future world of work, which are going to need much more kind of focus on technical and vocational type skills.
All right, Andrew, thank you very much. Andrew Brownlee there from the state agency Solace at 7:46.
The owner of a golden eagle is appealing to the public for help in locating the 12-year-old bird of prey who hasn't been seen since last Wednesday. John Nugent is from Wicklow and he joins us now. John, your eagle is called Caelan. How did he go missing?
Good morning, Audrey. Yeah, he went missing outside. He just undone his leash himself. They pick and pull the whole time and he walked out and just flew off.
And no sign since?
No sign since, Audrey. Day 5 without food, so I'm worried sick.
And there's no tracker on him or anything like that, John?
The tracker's always on a bird when they fly, Audrey. This bird is not flying. It was in the weathering station, so he was resting. So when they're down, they don't have a GPS on them. It's only when a bird, when you're flying them free, you put a GPS tracker on it for his safety and you can get the bird back safely.
Okay. And you're very worried because he doesn't hunt for food.
Audrey, this bird has never hunted. He's 12 years old. He's never been out in the wild at all. He's never hunted live for food. His favourite food is chicken legs from a supermarket. He feeds from the hand all the time and he feeds on their perches all the time. So I was trying to rehabilitate him to let him fly free, that he can come back whenever he wants to my hand and fly him and then put him in his wedding station.
So you're worried, obviously, that he may not last without food. He's been with you since November. I mean, is it possible he could have flown back to where he was previously? Does that happen?
That's a great question, Audrey. Yes, he could have. However, he's never flown free in this country. He's never flown free in his 12 years of his life. So he's would be kind of more looking for me as much as I'm looking for him, we reckon.
So do you reckon he's, I mean, where are you exactly and where do you think he might be?
I'm one of the directors of Newcastle Airfield in Wicklow. So it's on the coast there between Bray and Wicklow, basically on the coastline there. So we have an airfield there with 150 acres and that's where he's homed and that's where he's based. and that's where I'm hoping that we're going to find him, somewhere around the Wicklow area.
Yeah. And so if anyone really spots him, what should they do, John?
Well, my appeal is really to farmers this morning is please, please don't shoot the bird. Like, he's just, give him a chance. He's not a threat. He's never killed. He's not a danger to anybody. He could land on a fence post beside you. He could land on a shed or a barn or something like that, because that's what he's used to, that sort of area. So he could land there. So take a photograph and text it to me or WhatsApp it to me or call me, anything at all. If there's a sighting, I'll be there.
And he's instantly recognised as a golden eagle.
He's correct. He's the size of a swan, effectively, Audrey. If you see him flying, it looks like a swan flying. And he'll have two distinct jessies out of his legs, which is like little black, like sticks sticking out of his leg, where they're called jessies.
Okay. Well, look, I hope you find him. John, thanks very much for talking to us there. John Nugent, who is looking for his 12-year-old golden eagle, Caelan, who's been missing now since last Wednesday in the Wicklow area.
A vote by judges to accept proposals that aim to reduce the level of awards in personal injury cases have been dismissed by business groups as not going far enough. The figures contained in the proposed new guidelines show many payments have been reduced by around 50%, but business owners and employers were hoping to see cuts of around 80% to most minor injury claims, which would bring Ireland into line with other countries. We're joined this morning by Neil Walker, who is head of infrastructure with IBEC. Neil, what's IBEC's view on the proposed guidelines?
Good morning, Petulia. It's less than the 75% reduction that we believe is justified by our own research and by the findings of the Personal Injuries Commission. So the impact on our members' insurance premium, employer and public liability, will be less than we hoped. Although it is a step in the right direction, it's going to be really important that the government and the insurance sector assess the impact of the new guidance on award levels, including out-of-court settlements, over the coming year. I'd just like to say, I mean, that this is the culmination of 5 years of advocacy work by IBEC. We produced a report in 2016 called Time to Reduce the Burden of Personal Injury Claims. We could see this insurance costs on the rise, and as we predicted, it eventually became critical and crippling for SMEs. We looked at the guidance in England and Wales, comparing it to the Book of Quantum, and we found that the most you'd ever get in England was less than the least you'd ever get here. We made recommendations not just for the judiciary, which was effectively to set up a judicial college to take over responsibility for guidance, but also for the legal profession and for the insurers themselves. We spent 2017, 2018 working with the Oireachtas Cost of Insurance Working Group and also with Nicholas Kearns' Personal Injuries Commission. And okay, we felt, you know, by 2020, reducing the awards guidance was the missing piece of the jigsaw, but it was by far the most important.
And so those guidelines, proposed guidelines, are now in place. The government is to press the insurance industry to reduce the price of premiums. Are you confident that insurance companies will pay heed and that your members will pay less?
I hope to see that we will be able to collect data, because part of the problem, and it was highlighted by Justice Irvine, is data is simply not available, particularly for the out-of-court settlements. And even for the majority of court settlements, they're made orally, and there's no record of what's being awarded. So although they looked at tens of thousands of cases, the Judicial Council was only able to look at about 300 examples. So what we need to be doing is to collect data in a much better way going forward. And once the insurers see that the level of awards is coming down in the courts, it will enable them to make less smaller amounts for where the majority of cases get settled before they get to court. But the level of court awards drives everything else. So I think
should
we'll
we wait
want
until then, or should there be a statutory cap on the level of awards? Should the government return to the Civil Liability Bill 2019, which lapsed in the Shannon?
Well, I would say we did make a statement a few weeks back before the judgment came out that if the level of reduction proposed, I mean, it's effectively a 50% reduction being proposed. If it had been materially less than that, then we would reluctantly have said, you know, the case for a statutory cap becomes overwhelming. I think what we've got is enough of a step in the right direction that we don't need to pursue that route because it would be constitutionally quite challenging.
Okay, so there's something to work with there. Neil Walker, Head of Infrastructure with IBEC, thank you very much for your time this morning. Elsewhere, Deliveroo has announced plans for its London listing. The IPO is one of the most eagerly watched for initial public offerings in the first half of 2021 and is expected to value the company at more than $7 billion. I'll have more at 8:30, but for now, back to you, Audrey.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to see a gradual breakdown of our weather to more unsettled conditions this week. And though today will still bring some dry spells, we'll see some more disturbed weather through midweek with some very windy and wet conditions ahead. But not a bad start to today. Dry in many areas, but there's some rain and drizzle in the west and north this morning, and that's going to spread eastwards through the day. It'll get patchier as it spreads though, so many eastern areas will hold dry. Highs of 7 to 11 degrees and mainly light to moderate southwest winds, fresh on west and northwest coasts. Now tonight, that patchy light rain and drizzle will linger for a time, but most areas will become dry by morning, apart from patchy light rain and drizzle in the south and southeast. Lows of 3 to 6 degrees with some mist patches in light to moderate southerly winds. Now tomorrow morning will be largely dry, but the afternoon will bring a definite change to our weather as rain pushes into the west and spreads across the country. That rain will be heavy at times, especially in the west, and it'll get windier as this rain spreads, with moderate southwest winds increasing fresh to strong and gusty. Highs tomorrow of 8 to 11 degrees. Now tomorrow night will bring a brief respite with rain gradually clearing eastwards and winds easing to moderate, but Wednesday will bring further very windy and wet weather as southwesterly winds again increase strong and gusty and heavy rain spreads across the country. And the end of the week will continue unsettled. As that rain clears on Wednesday night and Thursday, it'll be followed by widespread heavy showers and blustery conditions. So do keep an eye on the forecast over the coming days for any updates. But for the moment, a dry start for many today with patchy rain and drizzle in the west and northwest spreading eastwards through the day. And that's your latest forecast. From all of us at MedEireann, have a very good morning.
This week we'll see the first COVID-19 vaccinations among medically vulnerable people aged between 16 and 69 who are at a very high risk of severe disease and death. This will be the fourth cohort on the priority list to get inoculated. Laura Hogan reports.
It's estimated there could be up to 160,000 people aged between 16 and 69 in this country who are deemed to be at a high risk from COVID-19 because of serious illness. The HSE said that the first 10,000 patients from this group will get their first dose of vaccine later this week, beginning with people with neurological conditions in disability settings. While 95% of people aged over 85 have received their first dose, the remaining 500 are due to get their jabs this week, along with other housebound patients. A further 37,000 doses have been allocated for people in the 80 to 84 bracket, from the overall target of more than 84,000 doses to be administered this week.
Around 100,000 children are returning to preschool this morning under the Early Childhood Care and Education Scheme. It's part of a phased reopening of childcare with a full return planned in 3 weeks' time. Our regional reporter, Theresa Mannion.
The ECCE scheme is part of the state's preschool programme, which is delivered by over 4,000 service providers nationwide. It entitles early learners to free childcare 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, over 2 years. This morning, these preschoolers are returning for the first time since before Christmas. Apart from the preschool scheme, childcare services continued to operate under Level 5 COVID restrictions for the children of essential workers and vulnerable children. Meanwhile, early data from primary schools 1 week after reopening is showing positivity levels of the virus remain very low. However, both the government and the National Public Health Emergency Team have been keen to emphasise that all phased returns to school will be monitored on an ongoing basis. Theresa Mannion, RTÉ News, Galway.
The operator of the national grid, Airgrid, and the Minister for the Environment, Climate and Communications, Eamon Ryan, are launching a 14-week consultation process on the future of Ireland's electricity system. The consultation will discuss different approaches to preparing the grid to run with 70% of the country's electricity generated by renewable means by 2030. Our economics correspondent Robert Short.
Under the Climate Action Plan, 70% of Ireland's electricity is to be generated by renewable means, with most of that coming from wind. For that to happen, there needs to be considerable investment in the national grid. Depending on which approach is taken, that could cost between €500 million and €2 billion. Over the next 14 weeks, EirGrid will host meetings and online sessions for businesses and communities across the country. The different approaches sketched out by EirGrid include government influencing the location of renewable projects closer to existing grid infrastructure in places like the East Coast. It's also considering directing where big users like data centres can locate. And it's considering new, expensive technology to tunnel renewable energy from the West Coast to the main centres of demand in the East.
On this programme, the chief executive of EirGrid, Mark Foley, agreed that public support will be critical for the plan to generate more electricity by renewable means. He said he believed the consultation process was as ambitious as any ever undertaken by a company in Ireland.
At the heart of it is a transparent expose of a number of options to allow us achieve the government objective and a commitment to listen and to engage widely, nationally, regionally and locally, and to get the voice of the people of Ireland firmly into the heart of this discussion, so that when we pick the right option and the best option for Ireland Inc., it'll be one that genuinely has heard people's voices and that is the best option in terms of impact, cost, etc.
Britain's Prince Harry and his wife Meghan have said that there were concerns within the royal family before their son Archie's birth about how dark the skin of the child might be. In an interview with Oprah Winfrey shown on CBS television in the US, the Duchess of Sussex and the Prince declined to say who had expressed such concerns. Meghan Markle, who is the first mixed-race person to marry a British senior royal in modern history, said the pressure she felt affected her mental health so badly that it led to her having suicidal thoughts. The couple stepped back from royal duties last year and are now living in Los Angeles. The full interview will be shown on RT2 television tonight at 9:30. Now the weather.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Super Value. Get thousands of really low prices in the Super Value range, available in-store and online. Believe in low prices.
Dry in many areas to start this morning, but rain and drizzle in the west and northwest will gradually spread eastwards today, becoming patchy as it does so. Highest temperatures 7 to 11 degrees.
Fallout from the Davy controversy, whether or not insurance premiums are likely to be cut as a result of the move to reduce payouts, and Harry and Meghan tell-all are some of the stories carried on the front of today's papers. Davy could tarnish Ireland globally. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Examiner, which quotes UCD Professor Niamh Brennan and other corporate governance experts saying that the government and the NTMA risk bringing the state into disrepute if they allow Davy to participate in a sale of Irish sovereign bonds this week. For its lead story, meanwhile, the Irish Times reports that the 16 employees who were found to have profited in the sale of Anglo-Irish bank bonds in 2014, which resulted in the stockbroking firm being fined €4.1 million last week, may now face the possibility of personal sanction from the central bank. Speaking on RTE's The Week in Politics, Minister for Public Enterprise and Reform Michael McGrath said that the regulator has a range of sanctions available, including fines and barring people from working in a regulated firm. The Irish Independent leads this morning with the line that it's unlikely there will be an immediate cut in insurance premiums despite the move to reduce awards to personal injury claimants. The paper quotes comments made by Moya Murdoch, the chief executive of Insurance Ireland, saying that premiums will be reduced over time and that her body believes that the guidelines don't go far enough to address the high cost of claims in Ireland. The Irish Daily Mail leads with the vaccine-related story, and that shooting in Bluebell in Dublin on Saturday, which resulted in a man and woman being hospitalised and four men being arrested, generates the lead story in the Irish Daily Star and Irish Sun. The Belfast Telegraph leads with today's return to school for primary school children in the younger age groups in Northern Ireland. And in common with the Irish News, the Telegraph also runs with a front page picture of Rangers fans in Belfast last night flouting COVID regulations as they celebrated their team's victory in the Scottish League. The Irish Daily Mirror leads with Oprah Winfrey's much-anticipated interview with Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, which was aired on US television last night and which is to be rebroadcast on RT2 tonight. Royals nuclear fallout is the headline there. Elsewhere this morning, The Times has a front-page story about the increasing popularity of private primary schools. We're told that there are now 38 private primary schools in Ireland, compared with 29 a decade ago. West Cork is to get its first ever domestic violence safe house for women and children after an anonymous donation of €400,000 was made to the West Cork Women Against Violence Project. That's on the front of the Examiner. And there are lots of stories and pictures about women in today's papers to mark International Women's Day. Time to accelerate women's climb to political table is the headline over the lead editorial in today's Independent. And the Times also devotes an editorial to the need for gender equality in politics, as well as carrying opinion pieces related to women's issues from Una Mullally, Senator Ivana Bacik and the Director of the National Women's Council, Orla O'Connor. And finally, Sarah Conroy from New Ross County Wexford, a letter writer to today's Times, also points out the role which female leaders have played in the fight against the pandemic. She points out that New Zealand, Taiwan and Norway are among the countries that have accomplished superior COVID-19 outcomes, maintaining lower confirmed cases and rapidly mobilising vaccinations. All three countries also have female prime ministers, which prompts Ms Conroy to put forward a view in favour of less testosterone in Parliament.
The HSE say they plan to begin vaccinating people aged between 16 and 69 and who are said to be at very high risk of developing severe COVID-19 later this week. There's thought to be around 160,000 people in this group, which includes those actively or within 6 weeks of receiving cancer treatments or surgery, chronic neurological conditions, respiratory diseases, uncontrolled diabetes, inherited metabolic diseases, intellectual disabilities, obesity, and sickle cell disease. Also included are those who are immunosuppressed due to disease or treatment, such as transplant recipients. Karen Moynihan is in this group, and she's been telling our reporter Killian Sherlock that she doesn't yet know when she will get the vaccine.
I don't know, I started to feel like maybe I was jumping the gun by getting in touch with my GP and kind of asking at my renal clinic, like, what's the story, when are we, who's going to be vaccinating and when does it happen? But just nobody seemed to know. So like I would have been in with my renal clinic last week. And when I asked them, they reckoned it would be my GP. But then when I got in touch with my GP later that day, they didn't really know either. So, and then in the middle of all that, an announcement had been made that we were definitely starting with cohort 4 this week, and it just seemed like this announcement had been made, but nobody who was actually going to be doing the work seemed to know anything about it, which was a bit weird. Yeah, so it's really just the fact that I've been kind of asking myself, really, and asking people and getting in touch and sending my emails to try and find out what's going on, because otherwise I really wouldn't have heard anything from anybody about it. You know, announcements are made, but then there's no kind of follow-up with it. So I suppose it's kind of just trying not to get my hopes up on it too early.
That's Karen Moynihan there. Well, people with chronic kidney disease or on dialysis will also be vaccinated. As part of this group, we are joined by Colin White, who is National Projects Manager with the Irish Kidney Association. Colin, you're welcome to the programme. The HSE say they're going to start vaccinating around 10,000 people who have neurological conditions, and they say that will happen later this week. Do you have definitive information about when people with kidney disease will get the jab?
We don't at this point have this information, and I think just to follow up on some of Karen's points there, that we need to perhaps temper our expectations that, as you've said, there's about 160,000 people in this revised group 4. We know that 10,000 vaccines are going to be given out this week, but I think the biggest anxiety for patients is where and when and who's going to contact them, because there is that confusion between, is it the GP, is it the hospital? And I think we accept that maybe some of the precise detail, knowing my name is John, when am I getting vaccinated, can be challenging. But I am part of the dialysis group, or I'm part of the transplant group, the cancer group, whichever, can I have some clarity on at least who will be contacting me and likely where I'll be getting vaccinated?
Okay, so there's no such primary information at the moment.
Not certainly within our community. We have yet to be informed.
Dr. Colm Henry at the NPHET briefing last week said, and from what he was saying, I mean, compiling that list of who should be vaccinated, it sounds like it will take some time. It's a pretty significant task.
I think a lot of the information is there, like particularly for transplant recipients and people on dialysis. Like the definition for inclusion in group four is very clear and unambiguous. But it's a matter of pulling together a huge amount of data of people who are based all across the country and then determining within the 160,000 people who goes first, where they get the vaccine, when they get the vaccine. And then the other question that is also being asked is which vaccine? Because the recommendation for group four was that if you can get it without more than a 3-week delay, that you should expect to get the mRNA vaccine. But then the announcement that things were starting this week seemed to lead with it being the AstraZeneca vaccine. And patients obviously have questions in relation to this. So I think the issue from a patient perspective is more to do with communication and managing expectations with clear communication. And I think equally, from what we're hearing, both the hospital sector and the GP sector need clear communication, because they're on the front line. So they're the ones who, as Karen alluded to, are being asked kind of the when is this all starting?
They're having to take the call from their patients. And you say that your organisation and others like you could help in this task with the HSE in compiling the list, as it were, of who should get the jab.
Well, I think it's more in terms of communicating that when the information is out. I think patient organisations have fantastic networks all across the country, and they can get kind of the clear messaging out, because that's what we need. Because I know even within our own community, we're having some people are saying, oh, no, my GP said he or she is giving it to me. And then others are saying, no, definitely it's the hospital. And whereas a patient organisation, if given reliable information, can kind of get it into the grassroots and stop the phone calls going in to GP surgeries and hospitals from concerned patients.
How has COVID impacted on people with kidney disease, people on dialysis, people who've had kidney transplants? Has it been a tough year for them, Colin?
It's been an extremely tough year. If you look at the people on dialysis, they were told, you're extremely vulnerable, you have to cocoon. But at the same time, they had to break their cocoon 3 times a week to go to hospital for their dialysis treatment. So there's the taxi ride in and the treatment and the return. So great anxiety. And then the harsh reality of the statistical rate on mortality of one in four people on dialysis getting COVID, unfortunately dying. So, and then for the people who are transplanted, they've kind of, to an extent, there's a familiarity with having to watch yourself in relation to infection because you're immunosuppressed. But equally, there's the challenge of you have your transplant, you are kind of, in some ways, kind of getting back to some degree of normality. And then the pandemic has been a huge reminder of the kind of the almost insecure status of their health, that something could very easily tip them over the edge. Yeah. And I think there's been that anxiety, as with all the people in Revised Group 4, that kind of family members or carers in that context are particularly anxious that they have had the potential for the last 12 months to bring the virus into the household if they're kind of going out doing the shopping, whatever it might be.
Okay. Well, look, Colin, thanks very much for talking to us this morning. Colin White, who is National Projects Manager with the Irish Kidney Association. It's 8:21.
And we are staying with issues around the pandemic. The legislation allowing the state to require people from certain high-risk countries to quarantine for 14 days in a designated hotel has been signed into law by President Michael D. Higgins. Plans are being drawn up to put mandatory quarantining in place. It's understood the day-to-day running of the hotels will be carried out by a private security firm. However, the Defence Forces will play a central role. I'm joined by Brigadier General Brendan McGuinness, who's commander of the Joint Task Force for Operation Fortitude, which is the Defence Forces' response to COVID-19. Brigadier General, good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Mary, good morning. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you and your listeners.
And the Defence Forces have been involved from the get-go of this pandemic in a variety of roles, and we will talk about some of those roles, but I would like to start with your latest role. And what is it that you will be doing around this mandatory hotel quarantining?
Mary, the Defence Forces, of course, will play a role in the mandatory quarantine scheme, as you mentioned. You also mentioned President Higgins has just signed the legislation very recently. Under the Department of Health lead, there's a wide range of state services, agencies and departments of government, and also now some civilian contracted service providers to be involved. The Defence Forces will have a role among all of those people to provide this mandatory quarantine scheme. Our role will be, I suppose, around the area of the state liaison official role, and that will have a sort of a coordination or a connection role between the services that will be supplied by state agencies, as I've said, and some areas of service supplied by private contractors. So it's in that area that the Defence Forces will play its primary role in this scheme.
Can you give us a little bit more detail? For example, will you be the controllers of mandatory hotel quarantining?
Well, the detail is being worked on as we speak, Mary. So there has been ongoing work for the last number of weeks, and there's intensive engagement going on between all those stakeholders at the moment. So the absolute definition of who does precisely what is still under design. So I think it would be a little bit previous to speak about defined roles just yet. But that coordination role and the state liaison official is certainly an area that the Defence Forces have a skill set and are very happy to support Department of Health and all the other agents to make sure that the mandatory scheme, when it's rolled out, will meet the needs of the passengers, but will also meet the needs of the legislation as passed by government.
Okay, could you, and I'll move on from it after this, but maybe you could clarify this for us. Will the private security firm, will they report to the army, to you?
Well, the private security company will be engaged with them, as we will with, you know, other areas. So, in fact, the Defence Forces will move between all agents, between, you know, people who have prescribed roles at the airport. We'll engage with them. We'll engage with the company transporting the passengers. We'll engage with the company accommodating the passengers, and of course the security as well. So we will have that overseeing, connecting role between all those services to make sure that the scheme hopefully will run smoothly, and as I said, as required by the legislation.
And of course, under Operation Fortitude, you've had a variety of roles. You've worked with the HSE, the National Ambulance Service. You've been in nursing homes and in testing and tracing. It has been a massive operation for the Army. Has it absorbed all or most of your time?
Well, the Defence Forces have been very happy, as you say, to be involved for 12 months. The Joint Task Force, or then through Operation Fortitude, was established in March of last year, so almost 12 months now. And in that time, as you say, Mary, we've been involved in a broad range of services, primarily to the HSE, but also to other state agencies as required, the National Ambulance Service. I suppose we call the four T's were where we started out. Contact tracing, swab testing, transport and tentage. So the range of tasks we've carried out has changed over the 12 months. People would maybe recall 12 months ago when this broke, there was a clamour for PPE. The Defence Forces assisted in distributing that. We helped the HSE and trained many, many people in terms of the contact tracing areas. We became involved in swab testing and stood up the Aviva Stadium with HSE clinical supervision, where over the 12 months, Defence Forces personnel have provided over 66,000 test swabs there. And I suppose in total, the number of man days the Defence Forces has offered across all those services is over 67,000 as we speak. A niche area you mentioned was the nursing homes. That was a particular challenge in the third wave, and the Defence Forces went in to support some nursing homes, but in non-clinical areas in particular, to allow HSE staff focus on
and
the
you've been visible.
I think the public
has seen the visibility of the Army in a variety of roles. How have all your members who've been at the front line, have they been vaccinated, or do you know when they'll be vaccinated?
Many of our people who have been engaged in frontline work have been vaccinated. At an early stage in negotiations with the HSE, who have been incredibly supportive of us, and we've had a very strong engagement. For example, we have a member of the HSE staff embedded in our headquarters in McKee Barracks. So we have a very strong relationship. And it was agreed at an early stage that when Defence Forces person were in COVID-facing tasks, that they would be vaccinated along with their peers in the HSE. That has proved to be extremely successful, and it has given great, great sustenance and support to our personnel, who feel their work is valued, and they're now obviously being vaccinated and can take great comfort in that as they work in those COVID-facing tasks.
All right, Brigadier General Brendan McGuinness, thank you for your time.
The much-anticipated interview with Britain's Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle was broadcast on CBS in the US last night. It's the first interview since making their decision to leave the UK and relocate to California with their young son. They spoke to Oprah Winfrey. Meghan told her she had times when she didn't want to be alive anymore. She said one member of the royal family had concerns about how dark her son Archie's skin would be. Harry said he has now been cut off financially, which is why the couple secured Netflix and Spotify deals. And speaking about his late mother, Princess Diana, he said he didn't want history to repeat itself.
I'm just really relieved and happy to be sitting here talking to you with my wife by my side, because I can't begin to imagine what it must have been like for her going through this process by herself all those years ago, because it has been unbelievably tough for the two of us, but at least we had each other.
Oprah Winfrey's Harpo Productions released a very limited number of clips from the interview. The full thing can be seen tonight on RTE2 television and the RTE player at 9:30. We're joined now by the BBC's former royal correspondent, Peter Hunt. Peter, good to talk to you this morning. You've seen and read much of what was in the interview. What's your overall impression of it and its likely impact?
Well, I think it will have a devastating impact on the British royal family. What's not clear is whether that will be a short-term one or a long-term damage. The most damaging is that suggestion of racism by a member of Harry's family. That question about how dark will be the skin of Archie. This was asked of Harry by a member of his family while Meghan was pregnant with Archie, and William told Oprah that he found the conversation awkward and he was a bit shocked. The identity of the person who asked the question isn't known. I mean, Harry also goes on to express his hurt that no one within his family condemns some of the racist media coverage that there was after his relationship with Meghan was made public a few years ago. But I mean, this is a charge. I mean, when we step back from it all, this is a family that provides the head of state for a multicultural country, the UK, and 15 other multicultural countries. And no amount of palace spin will be able to erase that stain in the coming days and weeks. Mm.
And in relation to Meghan Markle and what she had to say about how low she felt at that time, where she felt that she didn't want to be alive, and she said she sought help within the palace and was refused help.
Yes, I mean, the spectre of Diana hung over this two-hour programme. I mean, her son was by the departed Duchess's side for part of the programme, but from Meghan's account, and we do have to stress that this is the account of Harry and Meghan, from Meghan's account, this is an ancient institution that has had pretty brutal and painful lessons imposed on it, and they haven't learnt from it. And the lesson she was making very clear they hadn't learnt was the lesson of Diana and the mental health problems she had and the effort she made to seek help and did not receive. And now here we have Meghan in 2021 on American television telling a global audience that once again this happened, that she, as you say, didn't want to be alive anymore, had suicidal thoughts while pregnant, asked for help, told that she couldn't because she wasn't a paid employee of the royal household, and even the suggestion that it wouldn't be good for the institution if she sought such help.
And the relationship then between Prince Harry and his father, Prince Charles, it's very badly damaged.
Yeah, I mean, it is extraordinarily badly damaged. I mean, Harry looks close to tears while he talks about it, and you cannot see how it can be recovered in the short term. I mean, he talks about how he'll always love his dad, how after two phone calls from Canada, you remember they moved initially to Canada while they were trying to negotiate this sort of half in, half out, which was never going to work, sort of part-time royal, part-time earning of money, which was never really an option. But before they moved to California, he had several conversations with the Queen, but only two on the phone with his father before his father stopped talking to him and saying that he needed to put it all in writing. He felt let down. And he talks about how his father went through something similar in terms of pain. And he says that his priority is to try and heal that relationship. And also because, of course, the fact that Archie is his grandson. So, yes, it is a pretty devastating portrayal of how, from the son's perspective, of how his father has responded to what clearly has been a very difficult time for Harry.
Knowing the royal family as you do, Peter, in your work as the royal correspondent, will the palace respond to this interview?
I think it'll be very difficult for them. I mean, people were talking in the papers before it happened that they'd be hiding behind the sofa. I suspect after this interview, they've gone down into the sort of the wartime bunkers in the ancient palace castle that is Windsor. It is a truly devastating on so many levels. The racism charge, the lack of care to a person who says that she was very vulnerable, the criticism of a future king. These are really hard charges, and they're quite difficult to respond to. I mean, in particular the racism one, it's just a stain that is there, and it will be very hard for them to erase it. I mean, the person who emerges reasonably unscathed, apart from obviously the fact that she's the head of this family and the head of state, is the Queen, and both of them, both Harry and Meghan, speak very fondly of her. But I mean, I suppose what I must stress is that there will be people who will have watched this in the UK with utter horror, really, at how Meghan has chosen to present it. There will be people, you know, there are allegations of bullying against her, which she denies. There are people who believe that they did try everything they could to facilitate her entry into the British royal family. And I think they will be, you know, very, very hurt this morning, but it will be very hard for them to answer back.
All right, Peter, thank you very much indeed. Peter Hunt, former BBC Royal Correspondent. If you've been affected by anything you've heard this morning, www.samaritans.ie or their helpline number is 116123.
Deliveroo has announced plans for its London listing. The Deliveroo IPO is one of the most eagerly awaited initial public offerings this year and is expected to value the company at more than $7 billion. In a trading update this morning, the company said it had grown the total number of transactions processed by 64% last year to £4.1 billion from £2.5 billion in 2019. Revolut said that overall spending by its Irish customers in February this year was 19% lower than in February 2020. Spending on groceries and items for the home continued to increase, but this was significantly offset by the collapse in spending on leisure, hospitality and travel. For every €1 men earn, women earn 86 cents. That's the scale of the gender pay gap in Ireland. The National Women's Council of Ireland said the gender pay gap was further compounded by the pension gap that women face on retirement. Gender pay gap legislation requiring employers to publish pay differences between men and women, including any bonuses, is expected to be made into law this year. On the currencies, €1 buys 86 pence sterling and $1 US dollar 19 cents.
And it's good morning again to Darren.
Hello again, Audrey. We'll start with Sam Bennett, and he will wear the race leader's yellow jersey on day two of the week-long Paris-Nice race today. Sam, in serious form yesterday, won the opening stage, and he'll hope to be in the reckoning again this afternoon. The peloton will travel 188 kilometres and they'll finish in Amelie. It's a flat stage and one for the sprinter, so we'll all have an eye on the cycling a little bit later on. Hope he can make it from two. And he is in serious form at the moment, looks in the shape of his life. And his timing yesterday and the power he had to get to the line was just amazing to watch. He almost made it look easy, in fact. The Paris-Nice race, one of the most prestigious events outside the Grand Tours. In fact, it's considered a warm-up event for the Tour de France itself, and it's an extremely important week for the Irish rider, as he outlined after the race yesterday.
It's already an important part of the year, and the racing is so compact you can't really progress during the racing, so it's important for me to start already on really good form, and then once my first block of racing is done, kind of take back the form a bit and then go again for the Tour de France. So I think everything is going in the right way, and I just have to keep the focus now.
Yeah, Sam Bennett, let's wish him luck a little bit later on. Leona Maguire had a brilliant top 10 at the Drive On Championship in Florida last night. She ended the event in a tie for sixth on 5 under par, 10 behind the winner, Austin Ernst. Is having a really good season, just her second season on the LPGA Tour, and given how disrupted last year was with COVID, she's really beginning to find her form now and wins over $50,000 in prize money. Bryson DeChambeau beat Lee Westwood by a shot to win the Arnold Palmer Invitational. Great watch last night, actually, the big hitting American just holding on. Rory McIlroy was back in a share of 10th place on 3 under par, 8 behind the winner. Disappointing 76 for him to end with. Patrick Harrington also had a 76 and was one over. Sean Tobin finished 11th in the final of the 3,000 metres at the European Indoor Championships in Poland. Sarah Lavin, Kieran Neville, Molly Scott and Joan Healy all didn't progress to finals. But let's hear from Sean. He was bitterly disappointed with his run and he had some regrets, as he outlines now.
Pretty rough. That was very disappointing. Yeah, just feels embarrassing, being honest. Clearly the head wasn't there, so when I went, I didn't go, and my mind was screaming at me to go, and I don't know, I let it go and switched off, and that shouldn't happen at these type of levels. Like, we're all good enough to get it to a final now, but that's not good enough for us, so it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, Sean being really hard on himself there. Thought he did really well, and there's a lot more to come from him. In soccer, very busy day in the Premier League yesterday, and a lot of surprising results as well. Manchester City's long winning run came to an end, lost 2-0 to Manchester United. City, though, 11 points clear at the top all the same. Liverpool have lost again, 1-0 at home to Fulham. That's 6 games in a row at home they've lost. Tottenham beat Crystal Palace 4-1. West Brom and Newcastle drew 0-0. RT analyst Lisa Fallon joins me on the line. Lisa, can we start with the Manchester derby? Did City's standards drop yesterday, or do United need a bit more credit?
No, I think, in fairness to Manchester United, I think they really set the tempo of the game. I think you could see how high and aggressively they were pressing Manchester City. You know, they went after the game and there seemed to be a real confidence in the performance. And, you know, I think they were full value for it, obviously, getting a penalty and getting it converted so early in the game. But I think it actually comes from a move that showed serious sign of intent from them right from the off. They tore into the game. They weren't intimidated by Manchester City's run. And you wouldn't expect that they would be, but you could clearly see that they saw this game as an opportunity, not just to get the 3 points, but to end the run. And I think even some of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's comments earlier in the week in the lead up to the game kind of gave you the sense that, you know, his personality is starting to show in this Manchester United team. I know personally I was probably a little bit critical of them earlier in the season, where I wasn't sure you could really see a real identity to the team. But I think we're starting to see that now over the last number of weeks and even months. And, you know, Solskjaer is certainly putting his stamp on this team, and his personality is starting to come out in them.
Now let's move to Merseyside. What has gone wrong with Liverpool? 6 home defeats, consecutive home defeats at Anfield. What's going wrong there, Lisa?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I think Jurgen Klopp's comments were really interesting after the game. You know, he talked about not being able, not knowing quite what is wrong. And, you know, certainly momentum has shifted against them. But, you know, momentum is such a powerful thing, Darren. It's, you know, when it's with you, it's a really powerful, energising thing that gives confidence, belief. But when it goes against you, it can be very tiring, draining, fatiguing. Players feel knocks more, you know, when you're on that run of winning, and, you know, the physio room is always empty, you know. But I think, you know, they've had a lot of setbacks this year. And also, I think, you know, you look at how long it took for Liverpool to win that Premier League title. It was a thing that hung over them for so, so long, like not just years, decades. And the build up to winning that Premier League title last season was just hugely significant. And it was everything. It was absolutely everything. And I think, you know, once you get over that line, it can almost lead to a little bit of fatigue from that success, and to generate that hunger and that absolute will to do whatever it takes to get there. It can be a little bit difficult to find that again. I think, you know, certainly at Cork City, when, you know, we had that relentless pursuit of that in 2017 to win that league title, you know, it was a relentless pursuit over Dundalk, and eventually to get over the line, it was just, it meant everything. And yes, you go again and that, but it is really difficult to generate that same intense hunger and drive. And I think, you know, that's really what defines the really, really great teams, is our teams that have that capacity to do it over and over again consistently, you know, a number of years in a row. And, you know, Liverpool have had a lot of setbacks this year too, with injuries and like I said, you know, the times that we're in as well. So and there's also been, you know, personal tragedy within the camp, and all those things do take their toll. But for Liverpool, you know, they've Champions League now on Wednesday. It's an opportunity to go after a game that, you know, against RB Leipzig, and they're 2-0 up going into the game, and, you know, just having that fresh competition, one that they're still very much in, it could be the perfect tonic for them this week.
We'll see. Lisa, thanks for joining us as always. Finally, Rangers champions of Scotland. That was after Celtic's scoreless draw with Dundee United. Back to you in studio.
It's an exciting morning as around 100,000 children are returning to preschool under the Early Childhood Care and Education Scheme. Our regional reporter Teresa Mannion is at one such preschool in Galway City for us. Teresa, today the beginning of the phased reopening of childcare.
That's right, Mary. There is great excitement here at St. Pat's Preschool in the heart of Galway City. The children here are availing of the ECCE scheme, which is back in action now. It's part of the state's preschool programme delivered by over 4,000 service providers all over the country. And it entitles these little early learners to free childcare, 3 hours a day, 9 to 12, 5 days a week over 2 years. Though here in St. Pat's, they're not too rigid about the 9 to 12. If the children want to be part of the breakfast club at 8:30, they can. Have lunch at 12:30, they can too. But this morning, so much excitement because this is the first time the children have seen each other since before Christmas. And I'm standing in their little garden. It's an award-winning garden at the back of the school. It was a concrete patch. Now it's a vibrant oasis of tubs and vegetable plants and pots and little painted picnic benches. And the children are all here, and they'll be mucking in and helping out in the garden throughout the morning. It's not raining, thankfully. Great excitement. And I spoke a short time ago to the manager of St. Pat's, Niamh Higgins.
What we've done is we've put in place our play pod, which is where the children are all together in one group and they don't mix with the children that are in a different group. Kind of the measures throughout the day then are children are bringing their snack in a Ziploc bag, which is sanitised on arrival. We're checking their temperatures on arrival. Any toys or anything that go into the mouth, you know, are sanitised straight away afterwards. And all the materials that are in our preschool room are sanitised after each session.
And staff are wearing medical masks?
That's right, yeah. Our staff are wearing their masks. We have staff changing their clothes as well when they arrive. Lots of hand washing throughout the day and just managing the risks throughout the day.
Well, St. Pat's is a diverse, multicultural preschool with nine or more nationalities here. They come from Sudan, from Pakistan, from India, Romania. Very typical of a city centre school, a broad range of socio-economic backgrounds and ethnicities. First up is Sandra Bonito, who has her four-year-old daughter, Alice, returning today. She's from Portugal.
Oh, she's delighted to be back. She was counting all the days to be back at school.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday.
I think Alice is very happy to be back in school, Sandra.
Yes, she is very happy to be back. It's been very hard on them to be home and isolated from their friends. So I think they've noticed that it's not normal break, and they've been very anxious to be with their friends.
So do you think really it's better for children to be back in school? It outweighs any risks.
Well, yes, if the conditions are safe enough, if everything is, if all the other businesses are closed, I think the top priority would be to open up education.
You seem a little emotional this morning.
Yeah, I think it's been also hard on us, far from our family.
You haven't been home for
a long time.
And did you feel very isolated?
Well, up to a point, yes. We are used to being here on our own, but being isolated also from friends and staying home with two toddlers, it's been hard to keep them busy.
And a lot.
Yes, we live in Ireland. Yes.
So
everyone is happy to be back and back to normal routine.
Yes, indeed. Everybody is happy to be back, both parents and children. That's the overriding sense I'm getting this morning, that whilst it's been wonderful having quality time at home, particularly for parents like Kevin Gibbons from Chicago, who told me he works from home. He's had a lovely time with his son, Finn. They've got wonderful quality time together, but now they can each have their own space. It's good for the children. It's good for the parents. Everybody is absolutely ready for this return to school. But it has to be said that the government and the National Public Health Emergency Team are keen to emphasise that all phased returns to school will be monitored on an ongoing basis. But a week since the primary schools opened, positivity levels of the virus are very low.
Teresa, thanks very much. Teresa Mannion there, reporting from Galway. Before we go on Morning Ireland, to tell you about a collection of portraits of inspirational women in the world of science, technology, engineering and mathematics. It's being unveiled at Dublin City University today in celebration of International Women's Day. Let's talk to Marcella Bannon, who is cultural officer at DCU. Marcella, five women, who are they?
The women are Beatrice Alex Hicks, Catherine Johnson, Dr. Marie Maynard-Daly, Dame Kathleen Lonsdale and Kathleen McNulty.
Some of them with Irish roots, some of them not, but all incredibly accomplished. Will you tell us a little bit about what some of them achieved in their lives?
Yeah, each of them, these women are innovators ahead of their time who were not only satisfied with their own accomplishments, but paved the way for others and overcame many barriers to achieve what they did. Kay McNulty was born in Donegal and she moved to the States when she was very young. She became a leading mathematician and computer programmer. She was known as a human computer back in the day and one of the world's first computer programmers. She was one of only three female mathematicians who graduated in her class, and she was responsible for inventing the subroutine, which inducted, and she was inducted into the Women of Technology International Hall of Fame in 97. Yeah. Then we have Kathleen Lonsdale. She was a leading X-ray crystallographer. She became the first female professor in University College London, and she was elected as one of the first women fellows of the Royal Society. She grew up, and she was born in Newbridge, before moving to the UK. The other three were US-based. We have Dr. Marie Maynard-Daly. She was the first African-American woman in the US to earn a PhD in chemistry, and she disclosed the relationship between high cholesterol and clogged arteries. She also developed a program to increase the enrollment of minority students to medical school and graduate from science programmes.
And then, of course, we know Catherine Johnson. She was subject of the Hidden Figures film, brilliant film. She worked for NASA, involved in Apollo. And what do you hope this exhibition, these commissions, will inspire, Marcella?
We are hoping that they will inspire students, ordinary students throughout the university who come through DCU to see what they can achieve. I mean, these, as I said earlier, these women overcame huge barriers to get where they are today. And we also want to highlight as well, we've developed a website hub where we've profiled leading DCU researchers in STEM and STEM adjacent areas. So we also want to profile researchers in these areas that are alive today and doing great work. And we want more visibility across the walls of DCU in terms of gender. And we have two of our buildings are named after Kathleen McNulty and Kathleen Lonsdale. And so this campaign is part of that.
Brilliant. Okay, well, look, thanks a million for talking to us this morning, Marcella Bannon, Cultural Officer at DCU. It's a minute to nine.